line. Now, the number 480, I believe that is the number of active video lines, and whereas the remainder of the 525 is lines that are used for the retrace interval and the sync pulses. My question is, what are the total number of lines for the 720 P and I, and the total number of lines for 1080 P and I? Go ahead.
Yeah, this would be a great question to be answered by Eric, KE2EJ, if he's available. I'm going to go over to him, see if he's available to answer it. If not, I'm going to make some guesses. KE2EJ, K2IW, are you on board tonight, Eric? Maybe.
2GS with some guesses.
Okay. Roy has also got some guesses. I'm going to make my guesses first, and I'm going to turn it over to Roy. In the case of NTSC, which people make a joke, never twice the same color, National Television Selection Committee, I think it was NTSC, the old-fashioned analog 525 line television, 3x4, I think was the aspect ratio that we used for years and years. It has 480 active lines on the screen. The other 45 lines are used up for vertical retrace, odd and even, and some other information. So a bunch of lines between 480 and 525, those 45 extra lines, do not get displayed. They're part of the retrace, they're part of the vertical interval, and so on, in a ordinary NTSC picture. 480 are the real lines on the screen that you and I see. Alrighty. In the case of digital displayed television, 720 and 1080 and whatever, it no longer has to transmit that vertical interval pulse, because you're not locking a vertical running oscillator anymore, and a horizontal running oscillator. You're displaying, you've got a display matrix that's being directly put onto that screen. So there are no blank lines. It is my guess that 720 and 1080 are the real active lines. There are no inactive lines, is my guess. Because they're no longer required when you're no longer transmitting the signal in a serial analog manner as we used to. Let's see what Roy's got to say on all this. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Dick, thank you. Well, it's pretty much the same thing that you said. That's called overscan. It was necessary because of the technology of NTSC and cathode ray tubes. And if you had it misaligned, you ended up seeing a little bit of the edges of the overscan. But the modern technology did away completely with overscanning and time codes and such that are visible on the display. Now it's all digital, as you mentioned. It goes to a processor to decompress it from its lossy compression algorithm, feeds it into a memory buffer, and spits it out to the display. So there's no real reason to have any kind of additional video signals displayed as video. They're as part of the bit code such.
And what's nice about the current digital technique is that even if the raw data is sent to you in some other format, NTSC, 720, 1080, and whatever, 2000, 4000, no matter what the format is, once your demodulator in your television set recognizes that format, it can then fill up its display matrix with that data. In other words, each one of those pixels has the right amount of luminance and chrominance applied to that particular pixel, and that gives you the ability to refresh the picture onto the screen at any rate you desire. So you can be refreshing the picture on the screen at any rate, you can be loading the picture into the display matrix at any rate, and that display matrix sits in between the two as a place where you temporarily store the data for what the picture looks like right now. I think that's primarily the method of operation of our current digital television. I think there is the equivalent of a display matrix built inside, and now we can take any standard going in and any standard going out by using that procedure. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, John. WA2VDH, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, I see what you're saying, that the high-definition standards, 720 and 1080, don't really have a vertical retrace interval, per se, because it's not really a scanning. However, though, I have suboptimal cable. There is a video output on the back of the box, which I forget what it's called now. I don't know if it's component or but it's I think it's R minus Y or G minus Y, which is a scanned output that is active in the high definition modes. I've never hung a scope on there. I probably should play around and hang a scope on it, because it is a scanned video output for these high definition modes. So I believe there should be some kind of vertical retrace interval on it, but I'm not sure. I think what I'll do is hang a scope on there and just to see what that output looks like. But I understand what you're saying about not having a retrace interval. Go ahead.
Another nice thing about these digital modes is that the method by which the incoming raw data is now filling up your display matrix inside of your demodulator into your local equipment, it doesn't have to do it in a prescribed manner, per se. In other words, if only 40 of the pixels in the center of the screen change, there's ways that the digital input signal can tell those 40 pixels on the display matrix to change and leaves everything else as constant. So it can be very efficient, only giving you information as to what changed, or it can even give you a great big box of information if you're scanning the camera, so to speak. There's probably a overall command, you could say, that take all the data that's in the display matrix and shift everything 3 pixels to the right, and don't change anything. And it's, you don't have to reload all that data. Just tell it to hop the data X number of pixels to the right, if you know what I mean. So there's all kinds of ways that you can be updating in a non-sequential manner and taking that display matrix and displaying it onto your screen in a non-sequential manner. Again, only changing the things that go onto the screen that have changed. Refresh rate. And you could have refresh rates that are very fast compared to the raw data coming in rate. And the advantage of that is on certain kinds of data, you'll eliminate flicker and other kinds of artifacts, I think. So the one thing that's a little bit crazy, though, about digital television, let me drop this. The good news is that when everything's working correctly, there is no snow on the screen. No snow, no smear, no out of focus, and whatever. That's the good news. But as the signal gets weaker and weaker, as the signal-to-noise ratio gets weaker and weaker, it has an extremely severe threshold characteristic. The difference between getting a snow-free picture and getting essentially no picture at all might be like 2 decibels of change. You change the signal-to-noise ratio of what goes into your television receiver by 2 decibels, and you can go from snow-free to a message across the screen saying weak signal. Got a very severe characteristic like that. As such, if you're aiming your antenna back and forth, you've got a rotator in your antenna, and you're trying to peak up the signal. In the old days, you would peak for minimum snow on the screen. Nowadays, if you don't have a signal strength indicator on your particular television demodulator, it's hard to know when you've aimed in the right direction. And the so-called signal-to-noise ratio indicator really is not telling you signal-to-noise ratio. In many cases, it's telling you the bit error rate of digital demodulation, which is a function, a nonlinear function of signal-to-noise ratio. The guy who is pretty familiar with that is Joe. I'm going to pass it over to Joe. And have you seen evidence, Joe, that the so-called signal-to-noise ratio display on some of your more elaborate television demodulators really is displaying bit error rate, not really displaying signal-to-noise ratio? To B2RYY, if you're there, KQIW in the TechNet. Yeah. Okay, it sounds like Joe is agreeing, and I think I heard a low audio signal from Eric, KE2EJ. KE2EJ, go right ahead. K2RIW, the tech man. K2RIW,
K2EJ. What I wanted to say is most displays on a TV set do two things. They display analog signal and noise up to the point where it starts demodulating. And at the point where it starts demodulating, it switches over to bit error rate.
Okay, so some of them give you that information. I didn't know that. That's good. So I guess what I could do is intentionally put in a variable attenuator between my antenna and the demodulator, so it's telling me signal-to-noise ratio as I aim the antenna back and forth. That's if I believe in signal-to-noise ratio being a function of how well I'm aiming the antenna. Then again, if I don't do that, if I'm looking at bit error rate and I'm getting a multipass signal or I'm getting co-channel interference, then using the strong signal approach, where bit error, I tune my antenna, I wave my antenna back and forth until I get minimum bit error rate, lowest possible bit error rate. That could mean that I'm simultaneously lowering the multipass signal and the co-channel interference. Is any of that possibly correct, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW, K2EJ. When you get multipath, it tends to raise the bit error rate. Although the way the receivers are, they'll have a bar. As the bit error rate gets reduced, the bar goes up, which makes you think that the signal is stronger.
But I think if I'm getting multipath, I'm starting to get some inter-symbol distortion, which will show itself up as bit error rate. If I'm getting co-channel interference, I think I'm going to be getting an inter-symbol distortion that's going to show up as bit error rate. So therefore, if I'm looking at bit error rate while I'm aiming the antenna back and forth, I might be able to find the magic antenna direction where the multipass signal is sinking into one of those narrow notches of my antenna pattern at the same time as I'm lowering the magnitude of the co-channel interference. So I think both co-channel interference and multipass can each create an increase in bit error rate. And if I'm able to scan the antenna in azimuth, find the location of the least amount of bit error rate, I think I'm sort of simultaneously lowering those two undesirable signals. That's a guess on my part, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
That's correct, Dick. Anything that disturbs the signal, whether it's co-channel or multipath, will actually make your indicator read less. When you have less of those components, your indicator tends to read more, so yeah, you get a better, when you rotate your antenna, wherever it is, it's highest, you get the minimum amount of what might still exist.
And here's a further question that you probably know, Eric. Even though you've got a very desirable antenna location for your television receiving antenna at the broadcast center where you work, I do remember seeing you aim the antenna back and forth while looking at quality of signal that you were getting. In my particular case, I'm 30-some-odd miles from the Empire State Building. I'm looking through some trees. And when I'm doing over-the-air television reception, to have an antenna rotator on my television receiving antenna, even if I was doing nothing but getting New York City signals, I think it's a very desirable thing to do. But in other words, there are magic directions I can aim my antenna where I'll get the best reception from New York City in my location 35 miles out, as well as aiming the antenna 90 degrees away up toward Connecticut and picking up the Connecticut station. So for a bunch of reasons, it's my belief that a serious over-the-air television watcher has a significant advantage if he has an antenna rotator on his television receiving antenna. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Now, as was the case with the analog see, having a rotator is one of the most wonderful things that you can have if you're really interested in watching more than just the New York station. Also, it gives you the added advantage to just kind of pick your antenna up to the best reception on the channel that you happen to be looking at.
Okay. So the takeaway on this is that if you are or intend to be a serious over-the-air television watcher, a very rare breed these days, almost everybody is using satellite or cable. I think there's only one human being in my town watching over-the-air television. And I'll bet you in Roy's town, I bet you in Joe's town, it's very similar. Only a very few people are doing it. And I'm denying myself an awful lot of information I could be getting from cable and satellite. But it's a traditional thing. It's something that's always going to be there, I'd like to believe. So, I've got a rotator. Yeah, I've got to add a rotator on my television aerial. Joe has been using one for some time. We've gone down the list of people who signed in that did have a question or a comment. I'll listen for a couple of seconds in case somebody else has a burning question that won't wait until next week. Give me a call. There's a name right now. Take your IW and the TechNet.
I got another comment for you, Dick.
Go right ahead with your other comment, Eric.
Yeah, number one is, once you get closer to the city, you'll find more and more people watching on the antenna. You'll hear the statement that people are cutting the cord, but they're not using cable, they're not using satellite, they're not over the air, they're using the internet. So there's more of that going on. And it doesn't matter where you are, really. But there is actually an increase in antenna activity as you get closer to the city. You'll find combinations of over-the-air and internet usage for television, especially amongst millennials.
RYWKGPA.
Comment on the rotator use?
I'll be back to the rotator question in a second. Eric, make a guess, Eric. What percentage of the people today, would you guess, are using internet television watching? And do they get all the desirable channels that way? I'm pretty sure they're not getting the premium channels that way without the paying somebody a fee. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, it's surprising. The numbers of folks that are using the internet has rapidly increased in the last few days. One of the magazines has listed it as they're getting to be in the 25% to 30% neighborhood cutting the cord, and that's what's making a lot of the cable and satellite companies happy, because it's reducing their income. Also, the satellite companies have pretty much launched their last satellite, where they're offering their similar services over the internet. So the actual using the disk to get the satellite is going to disappear within 10 years.
WKGJ.
Wow. Interesting. So satellite television, you're saying, is going to disappear in the next 10 years. Are the people who are getting their television by way of internet, do they have to pay for it? How do they pay for it? Can you get pay-per-view by that technique? Eric, go ahead.
Yes, there's quite a few services, and you can get all of the above. You can go to services like Hulu and Netflix, or HBO Now, or DirecTV Now, and yes, you pay for those services. You know, you give a credit card. CVS has their own service. Well, they have the entire library of CVS, plus the Star Trek and a few others. This is like, I think their service is like $12 a month. Netflix and Hulu. They're in the low teens for the cost. And there's also the free services, like if you watch network programming, you can get them all for free. You go to ABC.com or CBS.com or NBC.com, etc.
Interesting. The person with the rotator question, go right ahead. Who are you?
I'm Dick Casey, 1SAM. When you get your television reception, let's say you're way out on the island, and you get it over the air with a rotator, everybody in the household hopefully wants to watch TV from the same direction. I moved to this location. It's very high, some 40 years ago when there was no cable around. And one of the reasons was the television reception. And I had antenna way, way up and a rotator. And I could get TV for vast distance. I won't even go into it. When I used to play around with it. But everybody had it watching the same direction. And today's world where you have multiple televisions and stuff, it's not such a great deal if someone wants to watch New York and you want to watch Connecticut. That's all I want to say. Over to you, Dick. Thanks for picking me up.
Very fine, Stan. Thank you for giving us that information. But your antenna was very high up. You were a television DXer. For a man of your resources, Sam, you had another choice. You didn't have to put just one television antenna on that tower. You could put two of them with two separate rotators. That gives the family another choice as to what direction they aim and what programs they watch. Television antenna is not that expensive. The rotator is not that expensive. Once you've already got the tower that supports it up high, adding the second antenna is relatively easy. I wonder if you ever considered that one, Sam. KC1SAM, KQLIW.
I never really thought of it, but we had basically, you know, one television, and it wasn't a problem. But in today's world, it would be a problem, you know. It was up high. It was rather expensive. It was a 7-foot parabolic, and I also had a large VHS, which one it was, long since forgotten. And it was way, way up, and it was on a rotator. And I can't get a setup like that now. It was rather unique. If I could, I would put a rotator on my 440 Aggie. But anyway, it wasn't necessary at the time, but just thinking today, you know, it would be, who turned that antenna, you know? I could hear it now. Casey, when I say back over to you.
Sam, it sounds like you had a tower. How many feet high was the tower, and how come you don't have the tower still? Go ahead.
Okay. What I had was a version, it wasn't a tower, but it worked like a lean-over tower. You know, the kind that's up and you can lean it over. It literally was a very, very tall, skinny tree dropped into the crotch of another tree, hoisted up with a hydraulic jack, chained to that location, top was pulled down, antenna was mounted on it, and it was let go up really high, and it was up about 110 feet. So it was kind of unique. In hindsight, kind of dangerous, but it worked like a charm. And I can't find a setup to do that again. That was just a unique physical arrangement of things that let me do that.
That's a very natural green approach, using trees. The antenna we're listening to you on right now, I believe, is suspended at the top of a tree. And your television arrows used to be in trees with a tilt-over mast. Wow. Very unique. That plus those great big dogs you've got. You're one of a kind there, Sam. Now it's time for the mailbag and or science talk. And Roy's got some good questions, good puzzles for you tonight. He wants participation, so the first thing that pops into your head, chime in and give him an answer to his puzzles. You don't have to worry about whether or not your answer is correct. We don't keep that kind of a score. AC1, here we go. AC2GS. My goodness. K2LAW, you got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and not much in the way of mailbag questions, although there's a subject that I was wondering if Bill WB2QGZ is out there, because he had a question that he wanted entertained that he emailed me, but I haven't heard him check in. So just for a second, I just want to know if Bill WB2QGZ is in the house, if you will.
I bet you he's there. He almost always listens. Go ahead, Bill. How about that? Back to you, Roy.
Oh, well, a little we may get to the topic nevertheless, because I wrote up a little something on it, and he can listen to the archive, and if he has any question, he can come back some other day, and we could expand upon it. So let me just mention for everyone, as I do every single week, the things to remember is if you want to contact me, if you have a question, if you have a comment, if you have a topic, whatever. The email address that's the best for this purpose would be mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. For all the links to graphics and articles that I use to make up this stuff, you go to your web browser, you type in roy.ac2gs.com, again, roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll take you to the link page and the illustration page. And if you want to join in on the chat room activities that are usually very quiet because there's few people in them, you just type in your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. Now, before I get to the first question, I would appreciate if some people at least check out the website roy.ac2gs.com because I have a picture puzzle. So in order for you to play with the picture puzzle, it probably is a good idea to see the picture. So while I'm doing the other stuff, hopefully some of you will use your browser and take a look at the picture, and we'll get to it soon. Okay, the ad came and gone. I thought I would bring up a subject that's been mentioned before in the technical nets and add a little puzzle at the end of it. The subject is something called Olber's paradox. Now, that's the problem that has bothered Greek philosophers way back when, but the astronomer Olber made it his own and it gave a name. The problem is that with almost an infinite number of stars in the sky, present calculations are that there's over a trillion galaxies, and the average galaxy can have more than 100 billion stars. Our Milky Way is believed to have about 200 billion stars. Why the heck is the night sky so dark? Now, anyone with any ideas? I mean, usually, I realize we've done this sort of before, but I thought it would lead itself to an interesting little question. So, anyone with any profound reason why the sky isn't lit up with all the infinite stars in the sky?
Comment?
Comment.
Comment control.
Comment away.
Because they're too far apart. 82CXK.
That's as good a reason as any. Big question, ultimately, I think, is what you believe the nature of the universe is, and that's up for arguments for some people. If you posit that the universe is infinite in scope and infinite in time, which I don't, but some people do, then shouldn't it still light up like a Christmas tree, if you will?
No, light diminishes with distance. Most of these things are so far apart that if you could travel at the speed of light, it would take you tens of thousands of years to get between them. So, no, it's just too much space.
Okay, well, but that sort of goes against the concept of an infinite universe, which is fine by me, but that's one of the things that people have a problem with. If you have an infinite universe, an infinite time, then you have an infinite amount of stars shining in your direction, and so even if it's minuscule and separated by millions of light years, infinity always ends up equaling infinity, and you're left with a white background. So I think the ultimate problem with that is that I don't think we are living in an infinite universe and not of an infinite duration. I mean, most scientists believe that the Big Bang is the initial beginner of the universe, and so there's a lot of starlight that hasn't even reached us yet. Is anyone else with any kind of running ideas of, in addition to what was commented on why the light isn't lit up? I know Dick has one.
There are various things blocking the light. There are nebulae and various other clouds of gas and dust that block a large part of the light coming to us. WB2GXM.
Right you are, Rich. That's another one of the answers. The non-infinity, infinite nature of the universe, and large dust clouds that have all kinds of artifacts in the sky. So that's another one. Anyone with any more?
K2RIW here. And that is, we think the sky should be white in all directions, because if you look in any direction, you're eventually looking at a star. Yes and no. Some of those stars are very far away by the inverse square law. The amount of energy you're getting from them is very low. But the word dark versus white is relative. You wear the right kind of light amplification goggles. You can choose a nighttime scene where the sky is clear, or even not clear. No moon out, nothing but starlight, and you've got enough light amplification, and you look around the scenery in your backyard, you'll think you're looking at high noon, except you won't see shadows of the trees like you would from a point source sun. By the same token, if I'm using an extremely sensitive, let me drop it. If I'm using a very sensitive radio telescope, the cosmic background radiation is 2.73 degrees Kelvin. In other words, no matter what direction I look, that amount of radiation from all directions is coming into my little piece of space that I'm looking at. So if I've got enough light amplification, that sky is bright. It really is a very dim gray or green or whatever with ordinary vision. But with the right amplification, light amplification, there is no dark area of the sky. You look at the ultra deep field picture where you see 2,600 galaxies that have never been seen before in this tiny little chunk of space that you would see when looking down a straw. That's what the picture is looking at. It's a very small chunk of space. That light is there. It's just a matter of your definition of dark versus bright. It's dark by normal human vision. With the right kind of amplification or a radio telescope, it's almost bright. That's an opinion. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yes, Dick, and it's a very good opinion. I was hoping and expecting you to say just that, because I pretty much my new little wrinkle on this is just a slight addition to what you basically just said. Keep in mind that there are some sources of electromagnetic waves that aren't really readily apparent to most people, and the cosmic microwave background that was first born when the universe was a spry 380,000 years, when ionized plasma and electrons could finally form stable electrical neutral atoms that would be apparent to electromagnetic waves and photons. Now, over the past 13.8 billion years, that burst of light has redshifted all the way down out of the visible range into the invisible microwave range, and it's up, like it peaks at 160.4 gigahertz. So the puzzle for tonight is basically, of all the photons in our lovely little observable universe, can't talk about the unobservable universe, unfortunately, but in the observable universe, what percentage do people think of all photons are part of the cosmic microwave background? Ah, come on, you know, it could be 100%, it could be 1%, it could be 50%, you know, throw out a number. You know, it's between 0 and 100%.
From one point of view, I'm going to guess, Roy, that it's close to 100% of all the photons that are emitted anywhere in the universe. Because energy is something that you can change in form, but you can't create it or destroy it. Those photons just go to some other place in the universe. there's no way they can get out of this universe per se. So of all the photons that have ever been emitted, near 100% of them are still somewhere in our universe. Maybe they hit an absorptive material, been absorbed and turned into heat, but that heat is still being given off as photons, so to speak. So my guess is near 100%. You can't leave this universe because it's everywhere. Oh, you're right. Take your eyes off.
Okay, that's a good answer, Dick, but the point I'm trying to add to it is that in the last 13.8 billion years, there have been suns in the skies, there have been supernovas, there's been a lot of things going boom and producing a lot of photons. So true, all the photons from the cosmic microwave background that were there at the beginning are pretty much there now. But presently, according to the best calculations, there are approximately 1 with 80 zeros following it is the approximate amount of electrons, neutrons, and protons in the observable universe. And also they say that 1 followed by 89 zeros is the number of neutrinos in the observable universe and also the number of photons in the universe. So there's a heck of a lot of photons. There's a trillion photons for every electron, proton, or neutron. So the question I'm sort of asking is not how much of the cosmic microwave background persists, but after 13.8 billion years, is it still mostly all the photons, or is it significantly less than the photons?
Chair, come.
Yes, Rich.
Well, throw out my guess as it is 95%.
Okay, Rich, that's a very good guess. Anyone else who wants to throw out any kind of idea of how many, of what percentage of all the photons in the entire observable universe are the cosmic microwave background, which we can't see, but which we have lovely little pictures of that are on lots of websites?
C2PL.
CPL.
Alpha Charlie 2 Papa Lima, I'm going to be the devil's advocate and say 1%.
Okay, thank you very much for being the devil's advocate. We always need one. So we have 100%, we have 95%, and we have 1%. Any other suggestions?
Roy, let me ask the inverse question. By what means can a photon leave this universe? If you accept the fact that they can be redshifted and converted to other forms, from one point of view, I don't think a photon can leave this universe. Okay, Roy, K2IW.
Dick, I never said that any of the photons left the universe or even were, say, destroyed, although I'm sure there's some cases where they were absorbed, turned into something other than the photons. What I'm asking people to think about for a little while is in relationship to the Big Bang and the amount of electromagnetic energy released during the Big Bang that kind of settled out around 380,000 years producing photons. So I just want to get a feel for people of the perception. Because when we think of the terms of the sky lighting up, we think in terms of visible light spectrum. And that's usually from a limited number of light sources, but we consider them to be almost infinite in number. So that's what I'm trying to get at tonight. Okay. Well, the bottom line is Dick is mostly right. Surprisingly, more than 99.9% of all the photons in our universe were created during the Big Bang and the ensuing 380,000 years. Less than 0.1% of all the photons have come into being since then. And so that's another kind of way of looking at it, that if you could see the cosmic microwave background, if you could, if your eyes could detect 160.4 gigahertz, it might be a lot brighter out there than we give it credit for. So that's my little pearl of tonight, of that almost all of the photons that we have in our universe were created very early in its time. Okie dokie, I guess it's time to move on to the next one. Hopefully some of you have had a chance of looking at roy.ac2gs.com and the picture. I labeled it the worst image of a celestial body that I've ever seen, and it probably is, but its nature is intriguing to me if you learn the story behind the picture. And it's not a brand new picture. It goes in the archive, but I think it demonstrates a rather intriguing concept. And so I pulled it out of the file. So if anyone has a chance to see the graphic at roy.ac2gs.com and wants to posit what the heck they're looking at, please, this is the time. I would appreciate it.
Will you be 2GXM?
Yes, Rich.
Well, it vaguely looks like the corona of our sun, so I would say that we're actually looking at a very bad picture of the sun.
Okay, that's a good guess. Would you hazard to guess why it's such an awful picture, though?
At a very, very low resolution, so it's probably taken by the first digital camera ever created by mankind.
And WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Well, because of a small amount of pixels, I'm guessing it's maybe a big object like a gamma ray burst, very, very far away. I know it could be, you know, a very small object, like Io, but with a very big camera. But I don't know. I'm just going to go with a distant object, a gamma ray burst. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, that's a good guess as well. I realize that I'm not giving you a lot to go on. Basically, it looks like something that's sort of round. It's low resolution. It could be almost anything. The underlying intrigue is not so much, it is, but not so much what it is, but how it was imaged. Okay, let me give you a hint. The camera was pointed down.
That wouldn't be the Earth's core, would it?
Would be a good guess, Lou, but no, that isn't the Earth's core.
Okay, something taken from the space station, WS2M, looking down. Of what? Something of Earth?
Not really, Paul. It was an Earth-based imaging device, and it was pointed down.
Was it a volcano?
No. It was farther away than that.
WS2N, one more guess.
Guess away, Paul.
Picture of Alan Beam with a camera that he pointed it to the sun accidentally, and that's what that's the only picture he wound up with. He destroyed the camera on Apollo 12.
Yes, it could have been, but as I said before, the camera was based on the planet Earth and was pointed straight down. And I'll give you another little bit of information. It was taken June 5th, 1998, and it qualified as one of those pictures of the day on NASA's website. So, you know, they thought it was important. So, and I'm sure you've seen it, because I'm sure you've seen every single picture of the picture of the day from NASA.
but I'm still trying to remember what this one is. Okay, I know every day they have a picture of the day. So, I just can't. It's not coming to me, Rory.
Hey, Paul, no problem. I kind of pick these things to be kind of close but not quite easily answered, because it wouldn't be any fun if people just kind of told me the answer and I said, yeah, you're right. Anyone else with any kind of thoughts of what kind of an image this could possibly be, having been on the planet Earth with the sensing device pointed down at the ground, and it's not the central core of the Earth?
AC2PL, was the camera pointed down into the optics of a telescope?
No, it was not.
Magnetism?
So it's basically sort of the same answer, though, right? You're saying is it a detection of the magnetic core? Lou, I mean, isn't that what you're trying to get at? Okay, any other kind of guesses? Anyone throw anything else out? Very well. Well, basically, it's the sun. Now, there are two great forces that work on our sun. One is the gravitational force, the ball of its mass, attempting to squeeze it together into a much smaller object. Outward pressure of the sun's hot plasma, and powering that great heat engine is nuclear fusion. A star with our sun's mass undergoes something called the proton-proton chain reaction. Now, that's when two hydrogen nuclei, which is basically just two protons, are squeezed together with enough force to overcome their columbic repellent force. And form a very unstable helium nucleus, free of any neutrons. They really don't stay together very long, and they tend to disassociate rather quickly. Very, very, very infrequently, though, helium-2, which is what that nucleus amounts to, can fuse using the weak nuclear force, it undergoes what's called positive beta decay, and it interacts with something called the W-plus boson and produces a positron and produces an electron neutrino. When that happens, then it sets up for a much more likely reaction using the strong nuclear force, which produces even more energy. Let me drop for a second. Now, it's probably a very good thing that positive plus beta decay it happens very infrequently. It takes approximately the half-life of helium-2 to go to deuterium is approximately a billion years, which is a good thing. It's a rate-limiting step for our sun, because otherwise it would explode within seconds and everything would be cinders. But it doesn't, and it goes on. The deuterium then interacts with hydrogen nuclei and through the strong force forms helium-3, and the helium-3 eventually turns into helium-4 and gets radiated out of the core and into the surface. But the bottom line is that whereas the helium and such takes eons to get through the core, the photons, as we've mentioned before, can take as long as 100,000 years to get through the core. But those little electron neutrinos that I mentioned at the very beginning that are the product of a positive beta decay zip through the core unaffected by anything and reach us in a little bit over 8 minutes. And that image is a image based on neutrinos coming from the sun, hitting the other side of the Earth, and being picked up on a neutrino detector. So that's the answer to that. That camera is a camera that takes pictures of neutrinos, and that's a portrait of our sun done in neutrinos.
Those cameras that are buried in the ice in Antarctica.
fall. There's a bunch of them. I believe this particular image back in 98 was done with a Japanese neutrino detector. But, yeah, they're building them. We did a story about that kilometer of basically under the ice sheet. So neutrinos are very important in research. They're doing all kinds of things. They're finding curious aspects of neutrinos. They think they might have found a very strange neutrino that's only been theoretical so far. So neutrinos, like I said earlier, we have a lot of neutrinos out there. We have as many neutrinos as we have photons in our universe. It's that, thankfully, they don't interact with us almost ever, and they're very light. So billions and billions of them are streaming through me and you at this very moment, and thankfully, it's having no effect. A VDH with a question? Yes, John. What actually forms the neutrino detector in that camera? Go ahead.
Next, tonight at 8 o'clock, W2VL repeater system.
It depends upon the method that they're using. The one that was the Canadian a neutrino used actually deuterium, a heavy water. They loan an enormous amount of heavy water from a government agency. I don't recall. I think it was the United States, because I don't think it was Canada. But they loaned it for a matter of years, put it underground in a large volume. Then they have optical detectors. And the concept is that neutrinos are very light, so they barely react to gravity. They're chargeless, so they don't react to the electromagnetic field, and they don't get by the strong nuclear force. The only thing they really interact with is the weak nuclear force. So what happens is occasionally they hit a nucleus, very rarely, but they hit the nucleus and they produce Cherenkov radiation. Which also was talked about a couple of weeks ago. I think Dick mentioned it about it. It's sort of a shock wave when material is traveling faster than the speed of light should be for that medium, not the absolute speed of light. And then there are optical detectors that trace that. So in a nutshell, that's it. Now, sometimes they change the material, so it's not necessarily always deuterium. But you need a large volume. You need to bury it deep, so that muons from cosmic rays don't give you false positives, and then you have a neutrino detector.
So to make that picture, they had to really, I guess, stare through that material for quite a length of time. Okay?
Repeater, timeout.
Strange, I never heard it timeout by itself before. Anyway, yes, it's probably a time delay image, and also a reconstructed image, because it's not really a camera. It's a bunch of photo detectors strewn all around, which track the light emission and the direction of the light emission, and interpolate what exactly is the direction of the initial collision. So yeah, there's a lot of computational crunching going on.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Okay, anything else on this? Any questions or comments or topics on this picture? Again, it's a very low-resolution picture, so on the surface, it's, you know, what the heck? There's someone's broken a digital camera. But it's rather fascinating that that's a snapshot of the neutrino emissions in the sun, because the sun is one of our major neutrino producers in this area. Since the fusion reaction generates loads and loads of it. All they had to do was point the camera down while the sun was on the other side of the Earth, and kazam, you got that image.
So if I understand you correctly, Roy, this picture is the neutrons that have been all the way through the Earth and hit the detector, and since so few of them will react to the detector, this represents an extremely long time exposure. This may represent a week's worth of exposure. And Maybe they did it at the same hour every day when the sun was on the backside of the Earth, so to speak. Okay, Roy, K2IW. Did the original source give you any of that info?
Oh, popular press really didn't have anything. There's probably some very technical article someplace buried, and I'll go looking for it. But my surmise, again, this required a lot of computational crunching. This was not something that just got spit out of a machine rather quickly. But my assumption is that they tracked the sun in the same general location, took a whole bunch of recordings of any kind of optical detection, days or weeks or even possibly more, and then crunched all the numbers together, averaged them, and came up with this wonderful image.
AC 2 PL comments.
PL.
Yeah, when I used to go to the particle accelerator up at Cornell called CHESS, they had various demonstrations. Cosmic ray detectors, where you'd hear a report every time a cosmic ray hit the chamber. And also we would be down on the experimental floor collecting data on a CCD detector, and if you didn't de-zinger the frame, you'd end up with these kind of shots through the frame that you'd see. If you did it on film, you'd see it as well, of course, but on the CCD, you'd see them, and it would be, everyone would say, yeah, those are cosmic rays. So how do they avoid cosmic rays saturating these particular images? AC2PL, go ahead.
You basically bury your measuring device because it's more difficult to go through too much matter. Cosmic rays, you know, really aren't rays. It's kind of a misnomer. They're basically particles. They're protons. They're protons traveling at very high speeds. They're electrons traveling at very high speeds. And there's helium nuclei traveling at very high speeds. So not any of them are really rays per se, but particles. But the one beauty of burying things under ice or rocks or what have you is you shield a lot of your instruments from cosmic rays.
Okay, Roger that. So these are very, very well shielded detectors, then.
These are all underground structures with a lot separating them from the surface. It's primarily not so much the cosmic rays that they apparently were mostly concerned with, but one particular cosmic ray, the muon. Unfortunately, it's sort of very difficult. You get the same Cerenko irradiation from impact of a muon that you do from a neutrino. So that's kind of what they were mostly interested in shielding themselves from. But, you know, it serves the same purpose. You wouldn't want protons or electrons to go skirting through your detection grid, because that would probably cause a lot of false positives. So, yeah, they're all underground. That's kind of every single neutrino detector that this world has is under the ground.
Roger that. Fascinating topic. Thank you. AC2PL.
Thank you. Anyone else with any questions, observations, or what have you on the subject? Or else I will move to the next topic. Okay, very well. Now, I wish Bill WB2QGZ was around because he came up with the question, but hopefully he can either listen to this archive or he can come by some Sunday night and we can kind of thrash it over again. Anyway, he was interested in time and time calibration and time standards. So, time. Something so mundane that few people think about what time really is. Yet quite bright physicists have been video-reviewed having a difficult time pinning down the concept of time. Time is something that we all deal with. Not even the richest man on Earth can pause it. Our universe is embedded in the fabric of space-time in which we all are traveling through. Now, Isaac Newton thought that time and spatial dimensions were fixed. But Albert Einstein showed that they were all relative. Time has always been important to mankind. When we were hunter and gatherers, we were more interested in when the sun would be in the sky and when it wouldn't be there, as well as the seasonal variations that affected what